Welcome back to BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money, and helps you understand how digital assets and money will evolve in the future. I am co-host Michael Blaschke, flying solo today, and I want to take you somewhere that doesn't get nearly enough airtime in the conversations about digital money, even though it might be the single most consequential dimension of this entire transformation. I'm talking about architecture, not the kind with steel and glass, but the kind with layers, protocols, and interfaces, IT architecture, enterprise architecture, the invisible skeleton that determines what a system can do, what it cannot do, and most critically, who gets to decide. Here's my thesis for today, and I'll be direct. The architecture decisions being made right now in central banks, in commercial banks, in fintechs, in protocol teams, these decisions will determine the shape of the global financial system for the next 30 to 50 years. And most of the people making these decisions or choosing not to make them don't fully appreciate what's at stake. The conversations are happening in silos. The blockchain people talk to blockchain people, the RTGS people talk to RTGS people, the DeFi people talk to DeFi people, and the IT architects and enterprise architects inside banks, the people who actually have to make all of this work together, they're often brought in far too late after the strategic commitments have already been made. So today, I want to bridge those conversations. I want to explain why architecture isn't just an implementation detail. It's a strategic weapon. And I want to give you a framework for thinking about these choices that I believe will remain relevant no matter where this market goes over the next several years. Let me start with a question that the IMF asked quite explicitly in a working paper they published in early 2024. The question was this: what is the TCP/IP equivalent for digital assets? That's a profound question. And the fact that it's the IMF asking this tells you something about where we are in this cycle in institutional blockchain. Let me unpack why that TCP/IP question matters so much. In the early days of computer networking, we're really talking the late 1970s, early 1980s, you had dozens of proprietary networking protocols. IBM had SNA, Digital had DECnet, Xerox had XNS. Each one worked brilliantly within its own ecosystem, and each one was a dead end because the moment you needed to connect an IBM mainframe to a DEC minicomputer, you were in trouble. You needed custom gateways, translators, and a lot of manual integration work. The number of point-to-point connections you needed grew factorially with every new system you added. The internet solved this not by picking a winner among those proprietary protocols, but by introducing a layered model, the OSI or OSI model, and then the TCP/IP stack that became the practical implementation. The genius was in the separation of concerns. Each layer had a defined job. The physical layer moved bits, the network layer routed packets, the application layer delivered services, and crucially, you could innovate at any layer without breaking the others. Now, fast forward to 2026. Look at the landscape of digital financial infrastructure. We have CBDC platforms, dozens of them, at various stages of development, each with different technology stacks. We have public blockchains, Ethereum, Solana, Stellar, and many others. We have private and permissioned DLT networks built on Corda, Hyperledger, Canton, Quorum. We have traditional payment systems, RTGS, ACH, fast payment systems. We have stablecoin infrastructure that sits awkwardly across all of these. And increasingly, we have what MIT's Christian Catalini would call corp chains or corporate chains. These are proprietary blockchain platforms being built or acquired by major fintechs. Each of these systems works to varying degrees within its own parameter, but the moment you need to move value or information across them, you're back in the 1970s. You're building bespoke bridges, you're doing point-to-point integration, and the complexity is growing factorially. This is why architecture isn't a technical afterthought, in my opinion. It's the foundational strategic question. The choices made at the architectural level will determine who can participate, who can innovate, who bears the risk, and who captures the value in the financial system of the future. This brings me to the IMF's ASAP or ASAP model, which I think is one of the most underappreciated contributions to this space in recent years. ASAP stands for Access, Service, Asset, Platform. Four layers that the IMF proposes as a conceptual model for describing digital asset platforms. Let me walk you through the layers bottom to top because the ordering matters. At the bottom, you have the platform layer. This is the infrastructure, the execution engine, the ledger, the consensus mechanism, the storage. Whether that's, let's say, Ethereum's EVM, Corda's notary network, a traditional database backend, or some novel DLT, this is the plumbing. It handles execution, communication between nodes, cryptographic authentication, and authorization. It's technically the most sophisticated layer, and it's where most of the blockchain innovation conversation has been focused for the past decade. Above that sits the asset layer. This is where financial assets are defined, their core characteristics. For a currency, that's things like state representation, issuance rules, transfer mechanics, redemption logic. The critical insight here is that tokenization creates a separation between the asset and the platform. A tokenized asset has its own identity, its own governance boundaries, enforced by cryptography, not by trust in the platform operator. This is fundamentally different from traditional banking, where the bank's database is the asset. The deposit doesn't exist independently of the bank's core system. Then you have the service layer. This is where financial services live. Everything from simple primitives like escrow locks or conditional transfers up to complex protocols like delivery versus payment, foreign exchange, lending, collateralization. These services operate on the assets below them. They can be simple or they can be extraordinarily complex. And here's what's crucial. They can be governed independently from both the assets they manipulate and the platform they run on. And at the top, finally, you have the access layer, wallets, mobile apps, web portals, API gateways, QR codes, everything that connects end users and external systems to the layers below. Now, why does this layering matter? Three reasons. First, it gives you a shared vocabulary. Right now, when a central banker, a DeFi developer, and an enterprise architect talk about a digital currency platform, they're often not talking about completely different things, different layers, different concerns, different assumptions. The ASAP model provides a kind of a Rosetta Stone. It lets you say, I'm talking about an asset layer concern, or this is a service layer interoperability question. And everyone can orient themselves. Second reason, and this is the IMF's key strategic insight, interoperability does not require convergence at the platform layer. Let me say that again because it's counterintuitive. You do not need all platforms to use the same DLT, the same consensus mechanism, or the same execution environment. What you need is convergence and standardization at the middle layers, the asset and service layers. This is directly analogous to how the internet works. HTTP doesn't care whether the data travels over fiber optic, copper wire, or a satellite link. Similarly, a standardized asset transfer protocol shouldn't care whether the underlying platform is Ethereum, Corda or a traditional database. The IMF demonstrates this with the Jasper Ubin experiment, a cross-border CBDC exchange between the Bank of Canada and the Monetary Authority of Singapore. One platform ran on Corda, the other on Quorum. Completely different DLT stacks. But they achieved atomic payment versus payment by standardizing at the service layer, agreeing on the same HTLC protocol specification, the same parameters, the same cryptographic approach for the shared secret, while allowing the local implementations to differ. The platforms didn't need to be compatible. The services needed to become interoperable. And third reason, the layered model clarifies risk. In a traditional bank, risk assessment is relatively consolidated. One operator, one system, one regulatory parameter. In a platform-enabled world, risk is disaggregated across layers. The platform operator carries infrastructure risk. The asset issuer carries credit and redemption risk. The service provider carries operational and smart contract risk. The access provider carries user security risk. These risks can compound and they can be opaque. The ASAP model gives regulators and risk managers a framework for asking at which layer does the risk arise and who is responsible for managing it. Now, let me take the architectural lens and apply it to something very concrete that's happening in the market right now. I'd call it the Great Platform War, and it maps beautifully onto the ASAP framework. On one side, you have what Christian Catalini calls the Corp Chain model. MasterCard in advanced talks to acquire stablecoin infrastructure, Firm ZeroHash, Stripe incubating Tempo, a payments blockchain at a $5 billion valuation, Circle building its own economic operating system with the Arc blockchain, drawing institutional interest from BlackRock, Visa, HSBC. These are vertically integrated plays. One company controls the platform layer, issues or hosts the dominant asset, defines the service layer, and increasingly owns the access layer too. It's one rail, one set of rules, one architect who is also the landlord, if you will. On the other side, you have what you could call an open network model, public permissionless blockchains, Ethereum, Solana, Stellar, where the platform is a neutral commons. Anyone can issue assets, anyone can build services, anyone can create access applications. Governance is distributed. No single entity can change the rules unilaterally. The Corp Chain model has obvious appeal. It's clean. It's fast to market. There's a single counterpart for compliance. For a bank or a corporate treasury looking to get into digital assets, signing up with a Corp Chain is like moving into a turnkey office in a prestigious building. Everything works on day one. And the names behind these platforms, MasterCard, Stripe, Circle, are among the most respected in payments. But here's where the architecture lens becomes essential when you look at these corp chains through the previously introduced ASAP framework. What you see is a deliberate collapse of the layers. The separation that the ASAP model identifies as the source of flexibility, innovation, interoperability, that separation is being removed by design. The asset is bundled with the platform. The service layer is curated and permissioned by the platform operator. The access layer connects to one ecosystem. This is the quote-unquote tenant model. You gain short-term efficiency, but you cede long-term strategic freedom. The platform operator can raise your rent in the form of take rates. They can use your data to build competing services, and they can change the rules of engagement because you're operating on their infrastructure, under their governance. History has a very clear pattern here. In the 1960s, Bank of America tried to scale payment cards as a proprietary, vertically integrated play. It didn't work. The breakthrough came when D-Hook created the Visa network on a radical principle. Cooperate on the platform, compete on products. Open governance, shared rails, independent product innovation. That open model is what enabled the card networks to reach global scale. The UPC barcode started as a cost-saving measure for supermarkets, a way to speed up checkout. But because it was an open standard, it became something much bigger. It turned physically inventory into real-time data. The retailers who adopted it clearly could see demand patterns, adjust staffing, optimize supply chains. The open standard created a learning advantage that no closed proprietary system could match. GPS is perhaps the most dramatic example in our sequence of examples here. The US military opened its closed positioning network to civilian use. It could not have predicted ride-sharing, precision agriculture, Pokemon Go, or Google Maps. Open access and unleashed a way of innovation that no central bank planning body could have designed. Permissionless access did the work. I'd argue the same dynamic applies to financial infrastructure. A closed platform, no matter how well-funded, no matter how prestigious its backers, cannot out-innovate the permissionless creativity of the broader market. The real enduring value of any foundation technology isn't control, it's the speed of experimentation at the edge. And that speed is structurally higher on open systems. The IMF paper, and you find it in the show note, to its credit, acknowledges this. It explicitly highlights Ethereum as a prime example of a platform where composability and open service design have driven extraordinary network effects. For an IMF working paper, call out a permissionless network in positive terms. That's notable, that's a shift. Let me now connect all these dots to the practical challenge that every institution in this space faces. That is interoperability. When we talk about interoperability in the traditional payment world, we're talking about a remarkably well-integrated system. You have payment instruments, your credit card, your mobile wallet. You have payment networks, Visa, MasterCard, Swift. You have payment processors, Stripe, Square, Adyen. These three layers interact seamlessly. A consumer in Germany can tap their phone at a merchant in Japan. And behind the scenes, a complex choreography of currency conversion, compliance checks, and settlement happens in seconds. The consumer doesn't think about it. That's the gold standard. Now compare that to the blockchain world. A user holding USDC on Ethereum wants to pay a merchant that accepts tokenized deposits on a permissioned bank platform running Corda. How do they do that? Do they, in most cases, they can't, or they go through a series of centralized intermediaries, off-ramp to fiat, route through traditional rails, on-ramp to the target system. All the efficiency gains of blockchain, the speed, the atomicity, the reduced reconciliation evaporate. This is the interoperability gap. And there are fundamentally two approaches to closing it. The first approach is what I'd call top-down bridge building. This is the corp chain approach, or more broadly, the approach of creating a single platform that internalizes all the assets and services you need. If everything is on one platform, interoperability is a non-issue. The multi-currency platform concept, like the IMF's XC platform proposal or the BIS's Project Enbridge, follow this logic. Get enough central banks onto a shared platform, and cross-border settlement becomes trivial within that platform. The problem is that this approach doesn't scale to the full diversity of the global financial system. You'll never get every jurisdiction, every asset class, every service provider onto a single platform. Sovereignty concerns, geopolitical tensions, competitive dynamics, regulatory differences, they all push toward fragmentation. You end up with what the IMF eloquently calls, quote unquote, islands of harmony in a sea of diversity. Each island works well internally, but the connections between islands are still bespoke and brittle. The second approach in term is bottom-up standardization. This is the TCP/IP approach. You don't try to unify the platforms. You accept that platform diversity is permanent and probably desirable. Instead, you standardize the interfaces, the way assets are described, the way services communicate, the way cross-platform protocols operate. You push interoperability to the service and asset layers and make the platform layer irrelevant to the equation. The Jasper-Yubin experiment I mentioned earlier is a concrete proof of concept. Two different DLTs, two different CBDCs, but one shared service protocol, the HTLC-based escrow mechanism that could operate on both. The interoperability wasn't at the platform level, it was at the service level. And the Banque de France took this further in their CBDC experimentation series, demonstrating how the same HTLC protocol, customized locally for each platform's capabilities, could implement multiple asset exchanges across different configurations. Now, here's the part that excites me as an architect. The ASAP model doesn't just describe what exists, it identifies where standardization effort will yield the highest return. And the answer is clear, it's the asset and service layers. At the asset layer, think about what the ERC-20 standard did for the Ethereum ecosystem. It's a remarkably simple specification. A handful of functions that any fungible token must implement. Transfer, balance, approve. That's essentially it. But that simple standard enabled any wallet to work with any token on any Ethereum-compatible platform. It created a thriving wallet market, it enabled composability across DeFi platforms, and it drove massive network effects. Now imagine an equivalent standard or a family of standards that works across platform types, not just across EVM-compatible chains, but across the full spectrum of DAPs, including permissioned networks and even traditional systems with tokenization capabilities. At the service layer, consider the Monetary Authority of Singapore's Purpose-Bound Money Protocol, BPM. BPM is architecturally fascinating because it sits across both the asset and service layers. It wraps underlying digital money, whether that's a CBDC, stablecoin, or a tokenized deposit, with programmable logic that enforces usage restrictions. A government grant that can only be spent at approved merchants, for example. When the conditions are met, the wrapper dissolves and the underlying money is released in its native form. The MAS identified two interfaces for standardization: the holder interface, which enables interoperable wallets, and the collateralization interface, which defines how the wrapper relates to the backing asset. Standardize those two interfaces and you can support BPM across multiple platforms, multiple currencies, multiple wallet providers, the network effects compound. This is where the real work of interoperability happens, not in building bridges between change. So that remains important, but in defining the semantics of assets and services in a way that transcends any particular platform implementation. Now I want to bring all of this together through the lens of stablecoins, because stablecoins are arguably the most tangible stress test for every architectural question I've raised. Stablecoins sit at the intersection of all the tensions we've discussed. They bridge crypto and fiat. They operate across public and private platforms. They serve both DeFi and traditional finance use cases. And they've reached a scale where architectural choices have real systemic consequences. The ECB published a thorough analysis of stablecoins' role in the crypto ecosystem. And even though that was back in 2020, the structural observations remain highly relevant. The core finding was that certain stablecoins, Tether in particular, had become critical infrastructure for crypto asset markets. Tether was involved in half of all Bitcoin and Ether trades. It provided essential liquidity for decentralized exchanges. Its quarterly trading volumes were comparable to those of US equities on the New York Stock Exchange. This is not a niche product. This is a load-bearing pillar of a multi-trillion dollar market. And yet, from an architectural perspective, these stablecoins evolved opportunistically rather than by design. Tether was originally issued on Bitcoin's Omni layer, then migrated to Ethereum, then expanded to Tron, Solana, and a dozen other chains. Each deployment is somewhat independent. Token contracts differ across chains. The bridging mechanisms between chains are often centralized and have been the target of catastrophic hacks. The Ronin Bridge incident in 2022 resulted in over $600 million in losses. The Bybit exchange hack more recently saw nearly $1.5 billion compromised. These aren't edge cases. They are the direct consequence of inadequate interoperability architecture. So, when you map stablecoins onto the ASAP framework, the architectural fragility becomes visible. The asset layer, the stablecoin token itself, lacks standardization across platforms. The service layer, the protocols for bridging, swapping, and integrating stablecoins into financial services, is a patchwork of proprietary and bespoke solutions. The access layer, wallets and payments interfaces, has to accommodate this fragmentation, making the user experience far more complex than traditional payments. And the platform layer is wildly heterogeneous. Dozens of different blockchains with different performance characteristics, different consensus mechanisms, and different security models. Now consider the growth trajectory. Regulatory clarity is emerging, MiCA in Europe, evolving frameworks in the US and Asia. Institutional interest is accelerating. We're seeing not just crypto-native stablecoins, but bank-issued tokenized deposits and central bank digital currencies entering the picture. The non-US dollar stablecoin market is growing too. Euro-pegged stablecoins are now the largest category among non-dollar fiat-backed stablecoins, though they remain small relative to US dollar-denominated ones. And this multi-currency, multi-platform, multi-issuer landscape matures. The architecture question becomes existential. Without standardized interfaces at the asset and service layers, every new stablecoin, every new CBDC, every new tokenized deposit adds to the fragmentation rather than reducing it. This is why I keep coming back to the ASAP framework. It provides the analytical lens for seeing where the bottlenecks are, and those bottlenecks are not at the platform layer. We have plenty of high-performance platforms. They're not at the access layer. We have excellent wallet technology. The bottlenecks are at the asset and service layers. The standards for describing, issuing, and interacting with tokenized financial assets across platforms, the protocols for executing cross-platform financial services, DVP, PVP, lending, collateralization, in a way that's secure, atomic, and doesn't depend on custodial intermediaries or proprietary bridges. So, let me distill this into actionable perspectives for the different audiences listening to BFRR. If you're in a financial institution, a bank, an asset manager, a payment provider, the strategic question is not whether to adopt blockchain. That ship has sailed. The question is whether you're positioning yourself as an architect or a tenant in the emerging infrastructure. Signing up to a corp chain is the easy path, but it's the path of dependency. The alternative, engaging with open standards at the asset and service layers, contributing to the development of interoperability protocols, building on neutral infrastructure is harder in the short term, but far more desirable in the long term. You own your customer relationships, you retain the ability to innovate, you avoid being commoditized by the platform you choose to build on. If you're in a central bank or regulatory body, the ASAP framework offers a powerful tool for thinking about where to focus your interoperability efforts. The platform layer is not where you want to spend your standardization energy. It's too technically diverse and the market isn't ready to converge. The access layer has its own dynamic and is being driven effectively by market competition. Your leverage is at the asset and service layers, defining what a well-formed tokenized financial asset looks like, its data model, its mandatory interfaces, its disclosure requirements, specifically how cross-platform financial services should operate, the protocol steps, the parameter formats, the trust assumptions. This is the space where public authority and coordination can create enormous positive externalities. If you're a technology leader, say a protocol developer, a DLT vendor, a fintech builder, the message is don't just build platforms, build standards. The history of technology is unambiguous on this point. Platforms without standards become isolated islands. Standards without platforms are academic exercises. The matching happens at the intersection. When a robust standard enables innovation across a diverse ecosystem of platforms, the ERC-20 standard created more value for the Ethereum ecosystem than any single application. The TCP/IP standard created more value than any single network. The next ERC-20 level standard for cross-platform financial assets could create more value than any single CBDC platform. Let me close where I began. We are in the early stages of the most significant redesign of financial infrastructure since the introduction of electronic banking. The decisions being made now about platforms, about standards, about open versus closed, about which layers to standardize and which to leave to competition, these decisions will echo for decades. The IMF's ASAP model gives us the vocabulary. The history of technology gives us the pattern. The current market dynamics give us the urgency. The TCP/IP of digital assets won't be a single protocol or a single platform. It will be a set of shared conventions, and the asset and service layers agreed by a broad coalition of public and private stakeholders that allow diverse platforms to interoperate without requiring convergence. It will be boring in the way that truly foundational infrastructure is always boring. And it will be transformative in the way that truly foundational infrastructure always is. The question for every financial leader, every technologist, every regulatory listening today is not if this architectural convergence will happen. It's more whether you'll be at the table helping to shape it or whether you'll be adapting to someone else's choices after the fact. That's it for today's episode. I know I went deep on this one, but I genuinely believe that architecture is the under-discussed X factor in everything we cover on this podcast, from CBDCs to stablecoins to DeFi to the future of cross-border payments. If you want to continue this conversation, you know where to find us. Until next time, stay curious, stay critical, and pay attention to the layers beneath the surface. Thanks for listening to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock'n'Roll. Connect with us on YouTube, LinkedIn, and our expert community on Telegram, both in German and English. For details, check the show notes. Visit our website, pfrr.info, for detailed analysis and complete show notes from this episode. Make sure to subscribe to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock'n'Roll wherever you get your podcasts, and join us next week when we'll be exploring another critical development in the evolution of digital finance. Until then, I'm your co-host, Michael Blaschke, and this is BFRR, our Bitcoin and Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast, bringing Europe's perspective on digital money to the world.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.